You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM. Welcome back to the Batuta Advocate radio show, recording live in the Diamantina Shire. You're joined by myself, Clancy Overall, and of course, Wendell Hussey, the Eternal Cadet. And I'd like to start today's episode off by saying, valet Olivia Newton-John, our first true love, and a pioneer. She paved the way for Kylie and anyone who came after that. As we record this, it's obviously the 9th of August.
Yep.
2022, yeah, we've just heard the news.
Yep.
And there'll be a lot of... I wonder if she should get a state funeral. She has been living in California.
Yeah. They were giving the Seekers. The Seekers lead singer's getting a state funeral. So you'd imagine Olivia surely gets one. Archie Roach. As well, a trailblazer.
Been a bad year for Australian music, losing a few greats. And also, another one, now that I'm tangenting, almost every one of my favourite mafia characters has carked it this year. Ray Liotta, Paulie, Sal, James Caan of Santino fame. What a great year
Like one of those years, doesn't it, that you look back on and you just...
Like 2016 when it was Prince, Bowie and Muhammad Ali in the same month. Damn. Anyway, that's just how it is. The pandemic's over. This is what we're talking about. Now, today's guest was there on the ground for last year's biggest story, and we're of course talking about the fall of Kabul. It was a long time coming, and there was a lot going on, you know, similar to what we're seeing with the war in Ukraine now. It drifts in and out of the news cycle, and very few people are getting a good gauge on the daily kind of developments in the war in Afghanistan or in the war in Ukraine right now. Today's guest saw a lot of it. It would be an unfair question for me to get him to explain the entire war in Afghanistan, because I think that's a question that we'll be asking ourselves for centuries. But he certainly saw a lot of it. So thank you for joining us today, Andrew Quilty.
Thanks for having me, Clancy. Thanks, Wendell.
Now, in your capacity working for the Fourth Estate, you weren't necessarily working for the Australian media. You're a mercenary of a lot of different publications over there. But what would you say your job title was? Was it first and foremost photographer? I know you got the gold Walkley for that. Would you say photographer or would you say photographic journalist?
I think photojournalist is the term, but my business cards went through a couple of different iterations while I was over there. I think most recently I had photojournalist / writer.
Yep. And that's why we're talking to you today. You've just released a book. You're an author now, August in Kabul.
America's Last Days in Afghanistan.
Yeah. And you were there, and I remember it when it was happening. I remember the live crosses were going to you. You stayed on longer than anyone else that they'd ever crossed to over there. Did it feel like that? Did it feel like you were kind of one of the last outsiders holding on the inside?
Yeah, there weren't many of us. And as you say, the media back in Australia came to me on several occasions because there weren't a lot of us to choose from. Mm. But yeah, there was, as you were saying, the war in Afghanistan sort of ebbed and flowed in our consciousness over here and throughout the rest of the Western world. And I guess at that time, although there was this impending withdrawal of the American forces, which had been telegraphed months in advance, there still wasn't that much media attention. So there weren't that many journalists. I think a number of journalists had probably planned to fly in maybe a week before August 31, which was when the withdrawal was meant to conclude. But, the way most journalists work these days, they don't have time to spend months in advance leading up to this story. So it was really only those of us who lived there who were there at the time.
And you'd been living there for 9 years. And then as that withdrawal was coming, you were actually overseas at a wedding in France. And it all kind of happened a lot quicker than people were predicting and people were thinking. So you flew back in as it was all escalating, as everything was becoming so real. You were flying back in into the middle of it as so many people were disappearing and fleeing the country.
Yeah, I was over there for a wedding in France, as seemed to happen every year in summer there. It was kind of it was always a nice excuse to have a bit of a break. And so I had one in early August, and I was planning to spend a couple of weeks out just to take a breath. And at the same time, actually, was while I was at the wedding and the first weekend of August, the first of Afghanistan's 34 main cities fell to the Taliban. And there are a lot of kind of Kabul watchers at this wedding, and we were sort of looking at each other going, well, what does this mean? And we weren't too worried. Then the next day, two more cities fell. And then 2 days after that, three more cities fell. And we're starting to look at the maps, like watching the Taliban sort of converge on Kabul. And a few days after that, it got to the point where I realized, like, if I didn't get the next plane back to Kabul, I wasn't going to get in before the Taliban had Kabul surrounded and the airport inevitably closed.
Kabul watchers. I like that term. It's like, especially I like to envision the Kabul watchers at the back of the wedding on their phones, kind of like Kiwis at a wedding when the All Blacks are playing, just kind of zooming into the goings on of, you know, your life and everything you've worked for. And you're right. 9 years you spent thereabouts in Afghanistan, you don't want to miss that. You don't want to miss this kind of moment, you know, in terms of your coverage.
No, it's definitely not a dead rubber in the Bledisloe card.
No, it certainly wasn't that. But it's obviously something that's always omnipresent with you. Like, I mean, even now, do you still find yourself kind of sussing out what's going on, or have you?
I do, but I've tried to remove myself a little bit. I've, you know, cut off my Afghanistan Taliban Google alerts and tried to drop out of WhatsApp groups and things just to tune out, because, I mean, to be honest, I find it pretty depressing.
Yeah.
One of the things that kept me there for so long was having a little bit of hope in individuals sort of pushing against the tide of pessimism there. And after last August, I find it pretty hard to find any optimism. So I'm kind of trying to tune out. And that's difficult now, obviously, launching this book and also with the 1 year anniversary, it's sort of back, you know, it's coming back into the consciousness. But you know, that'll be for a heartbeat. That'll be back to everything else.
Now, I want to go back to a time before that was on your mind and before you were Afghanistan adjacent, I guess you could say. I want to know what makes a young, good-looking rooster from Sydney's north side pick up a camera and go to ground zero, I guess, of, you know, one of the biggest kind of conflicts of our lifetime. What, for one, get me into the photography. How did that become a thing? Because, you know, there's photography. There's many, many different layers to photography. There's those poor buggers that get asked to photograph funerals, and I hope no one's done that to you because that's offensive. And then there's, you know, people that like playing with cameras, and then there's people that do it for a job. And then there's people that take it one further and document. How did you find yourself as the latter?
I really fell into it in a number of kind of incidental events. The first one was probably the fact that I had two uncles who were photographers, professional photographers. And one of them gave me one of his old Nikon F3s, this sort of classic old film camera that he was no longer using. And not because I had any particular interest in it, but because I mean, visual art was my favorite subject at school. And I guess, and I also looked up to these two uncles. They were kind of my cool uncles. And I guess they thought that I could put it to use. And so the first time I put it to use was when I traveled around Australia in an old 1981 High Ace with a pop top with a couple of friends. And I took the camera with me and you know, 20 rolls of film or something, and found a hiding spot for it in the van where I thought it would be safe. And actually, a week into the trip, we're having a surf up in Kingscliff near the New South Wales Queensland border, and the van got broken into and they stole everything except our boards and our wetsuits, which we were wearing at the time, my camera gear and our booklet of CDs, which is filled with mostly Cold Chisel, Bon Jovi and Midnight Oil.
So we
were pretty offended by that.
So you got to keep the camera.
Got to keep the camera. Yeah. You know, I just took very rudimentary, you know, documentary photos of this trip, just, you know, my friends and the van in front of, you know, our campsites and campfires and whatnot. And, you know, I had no professional training or ambition even at that point, but I kind of enjoyed it. And I thought, you know, I came out of a private school where you left feeling as though you had to have a career. You couldn't just go and be an artist or you know, you had to have a real career. So I thought, well, I like creativity, photography. Maybe I can join these two and make an actual career out of it. So I studied at, I went to Ultimo TAFE down the road here, and still not knowing what kind of photography I wanted to go into, I could easily have ended up in, you know, fashion or advertising or funerals. And it happened that at the same time I was working at a bottle shop where a photo editor at what used to be Fairfax used to work, and he used to come in and sort of took an interest in me and what I was doing, and he'd bring rolls of film in for me to shoot. And once he said, you know, why don't you come in, do some work experience, see what we do. And I came in, I was doing work experience at the Financial Review photo department, which sounds pretty dry photography wise, but there were some really good photographers there, and it was also two floors below where the Sydney Morning Herald photographers worked. And I met a lot of them and, you know, kind of fell under their orbit. A couple of them took me under their wings, and these were photographers who kind of had social consciences and were using photography to express that. And yeah, they really took me under their wing, not only in photography, but in music and what they were reading and things. And it was really that couple of years in the early to mid 2000s that kind of set me on this path, using photography to tell stories and look at social, cultural, political issues.
So, like, it felt like, looking back, did it feel like a cadetship? Did it feel like, you know, like a natural career progression? Because I know a lot of people that go to kind of, you know, you go to a hardened football mad Catholic school. Anyone who ends up in some form of self-expression can often be viewed as like an alien. You know, as you said, you had the pressure to get a career. Well, you had one, and it was very similar to many other careers. You know, once upon a time, nurses would be a cadetship, or, you know, all kinds of different trades before they kind of got professionalized. And journalism was a big one like that too. You know, it was... Mm. Journalism was, you just find whatever Wyandotte Fairfax journo that you've, you know, made friends with, and they take you under their wing, and it actually very much becomes a career. So you didn't feel yourself wanting to be, could you even see war correspondent in the headlights at that point, or?
No, not at all. I mean, when I left school, I didn't really have an interest in world affairs. Mm. I certainly didn't have any knowledge. I wasn't, I never read for pleasure. I certainly didn't read the newspaper or watch the news. Actually, like, just to go off on a tangent of what you're saying about that private Catholic boys' school culture, I mean, it was weird then. The people who were doing what I guess we now consider cool stuff at school, like music or art or creative writing or whatever, which was considered then, like, you know, we were the weirdos or the outcasts or... Yeah. Or, you know, at the time, like, insert, you know...
Yeah,
homophobic slurs, yeah. And then, you know, a few years out, when you're doing it as a job, it's like, you know, it kind of flips and everyone's like, oh, wow, that's cool. Like, you know, as you know, they're working their job in, you know, real estate or law or engineering or whatever.
And they get blown away that you didn't have to kind of do exactly what your dad did.
Mm.
That's an interesting thing. You see it a lot... because I guess these schools don't really celebrate their exports either. You know what I mean? Like, you could have every wallaby on the wall, but you won't have an ARIA-winning musician, even though they're likely going to be remembered for 50 years longer. So it is, I mean, for one, it's amazing that you found this career, given it's not really encouraged by, you know, these educators. Do you find that you came from a household where they were celebrating, you know, artistic self-expression?
Yeah, it was certainly encouraged.
Yeah.
My mother was very creative and is actually at the age of 70 completed her own bachelor in visual arts.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations, Mum.
Yeah. So it was always certainly encouraged. And, you know, when I wanted to, like, build a dark room in the corner of the garage, they were all for it. Yeah. And
better than him in there smoking billies.
Maybe a bit of both.
Save that for the high ass.
What goes in the dark room stays in the dark room. Yeah.
So you were saying that you didn't really have an idea of where you were going to end up in terms of a career. How did you go from being at Fairfax and doing a few bits and pieces to landing in the middle of a war zone?
Well, the first war zone would have been 2006 on Cronulla Beach.
Ah, true. 2005.
2005,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
I haven't got that ingrained into my memory that time, but I'm sure you do. That was, I mean, the first time I saw your name attached to photographs. Cronulla riots.
Yeah, I think, I guess that was around the early stages where I was looking for something to point a camera at, something mm-hmm. that mattered to me. And I was a surfer and I was living on the northern beaches at that time and pretty aware of that this, like, you know, pretty ultra masculine localized culture where, you know, if you're not from here, you're not welcome.
Yeah. The Insular Peninsula?
The Insular Peninsula, yeah.
Locals only is always, well, yeah, it's a uniquely surfer thing too.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't hear people say locals only in Ipswich. Please, please come join us.
Yeah. Or ride with us or collide with us, as the Braboys say. No offence to any Braboys listening. Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of a confluence of these couple of these elements that I was interested in, and you know, it was sort of all over the news in the week leading up, and I thought I'll head down and
did you get the text?
I never got the text, no, I was obviously moving in the wrong circles, or the right circles, yeah.
Your Nokia didn't invite you to a race riot?
but yeah, so it was intense, and but as a photographer, it was like, oh, I'm finally in the right place. I felt like I was in the right place to be where there was stuff that was important to point a camera at.
I want to ask about how you hold yourself in that situation. I mean, Cronulla is a great example because it certainly doesn't involve, at that point, it didn't have any weapons. There were no weapons involved. It wasn't a kind of, you know, you didn't have the US Army on the ground. It was a shameful chapter in Australian history, but it's a bit different to a war in the Middle East. Can you tell me, in that situation where you've got the camera, how do you reconcile with, you know, your own conscience? You'd strike me as the type of guy who might be programmed to help de-escalate things, you know, if you see something going on. If you see something happening around you in a pub, in, you know, in the streets, on an aeroplane, you know. We've all got that in us to, you know, calm someone down, just woo up a little bit, mate. But in somewhere like Cronulla, where it's all happening around you, and I think this is a kind of good case study for what kind of happened later in your career, how do you just keep pressing the camera? You obviously need to point a camera at it, as you said. But how do you not switch into the role of the police officer?
Yeah, very good question. I mean, to be completely honest, in those situations, you're really trying to blend in with the crowd. Mm-hmm. And that often means making yourself appear to be one of them.
Yep.
So on that day, I remember I consciously dressed in a way that I thought I'll fit in. I mean, it also happened that I had a shaved head at the time, which was
scribble on a few tattoos.
Strange coincidence.
Getting the Southern Cross on your chest.
Yeah, I mean, didn't go that far, but you know, when you're around, in this case, these guys, your body language is suggesting that you're with them, mm-hmm. and to an extent, you have to be if you want them to accept you.
Yeah.
And the same goes for working in Afghanistan. Like on the day, you know, in many ways you compared this to a war zone where there's, you know, on the one hand it's fists and feet and broken bottles,
yeah.
And the other there's, you know, firearms.
Yeah.
But my approach is not dissimilar mm-hmm. in either. You have to kind of be at one. You have to pick the mood and fit in with it and go with it. And particularly when there's crowds, I mean. You know, there's something that's predictable about a front line. You know where the bad guys are. You know where you're safe to an extent. In a crowd, you're really at the whim of the crowd. And I mean, I find it pretty terrifying, actually. I was certainly after last year in crowds trying to get in the airport. Mm-hmm. But there's something, you have no sense of control yep. in a crowd. And sorry, to your question about, you know, whether you sort of step in or not. Again, I mean, in a crowd situation, that's incredibly difficult. I was pretty young. I mean, I was young, immature. I didn't really know what I was doing or who I was really at that time. And so, yeah, look, to be completely honest, I was really just photographing those days. I was pretty, you know, shocked by what I was seeing. There were actually a lot of guys amongst the rioters who were putting themselves between the fists and those that were being directed at. And obviously the cops were there, but there were a few situations where, it was lucky no one was killed that day, I think. But yeah, I wasn't really, I mean, fortunately or not, I was never really in a position where I think I could have affected any change. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a question that me and my colleagues have to ask ourselves at times.
More change can probably be affected with the photographs that place in history.
Some of the photos that you would see, and we're talking about these, I wouldn't say iconic, but those famous images of the Cronulla riots were taken by you, you know, and we probably, in a country that is such a big fan of revisionist history, it probably was more important that you weren't grabbing someone's arm. Probably more important that you were documenting that day on the beach because, you know, the local member ended up becoming prime minister and he never mentioned it once. So that's a part of the job. It feels like, you know, as you said, you and your colleagues are asking yourselves that every day.
In that moment with the camera, obviously you would stand out from the crowd as someone who's being there with the camera trying to document that. How often do people react to that, or do people, you obviously stand out, do people go for you, or do they ever, how do they react to a guy with a camera being around them, taking pictures and documenting what's going on?
Really depends on the moment, like how much that situation has developed, how long it's been going on for, what impact the media is having on it. So you had, for instance, that day, the media wasn't really getting targeted at all. Because I feel like the people there felt like they were on the right side of history. They were they were justified. Exactly. Yeah. However, the days that followed, when, you know, their pictures were appearing on the front page of the paper, and the cops were going after them, and in some cases subpoenaing.
Yeah,
I feel like it's
subpoenaing
hyphen ing.
photographers' photos, which I thought was stepping over the line because it makes us kind of partial in a way, or makes for the potential for us to be incriminating people, which, you know, I mean, in a sense we are if those pictures are being published, but I think if the cops are taking it one step further and go through our
evidence.
That's tricky. But again, it's really dependent on the circumstances. Like in, and that's what, again, just to compare it to Kabul last year when the Taliban were coming in, we had no idea how we were going to be received by the Taliban. There was a, you know, real shift in the dynamics on the ground and the mood as far as how Westerners were perceived at that time. And on the day that the Taliban came in, for the first time, I felt a real hostility from people that were angry, like who were felt they were being abandoned. And, you know, me and the other photographer I was roaming around with, we felt like really vulnerable. It's like we are the only foreigners around. If someone wants to take out their anger on a foreigner, like we're it, you know, whether we agree with what's going on or not. So it really, I don't know, you got to kind of keep your finger on the pulse and, you know, be ready to bolt if you need to, especially when, you know, first confronted with Taliban in Kabul. Like they hadn't been given orders like what to do with foreigners if we come across them. 24 hours, if it had happened 24 hours ago, we would have been locked up and thrown in a cave and God knows what would happen. So
you're saying it doesn't really matter, like 9 years developing a rapport with this city, that shift, it's a different city.
Yeah, all bets are off on that day. It really shifted and everyone's, you know, everyone goes into survival mode and people's allegiances shift. One day they might have, you know, a decal on the back windscreen of their car of a pro-Republican soldier that was killed, and then the next day they're, you know, ripping it off and putting a Taliban flag up the back just as a means of survival.
Yeah. The means of survival is something I kind of want to touch on too, because it was so hard for, and you know, and you people like you help explain this to the rest of the world, but it's so hard to understand Afghanistan when you look at, you know, history thousands of years back. Did you feel like there was an element of, is it for survival, swapping sides, or was there a latent support of a regime or an idea of a regime? Did you feel like, in your time there, in 9 years, what was the general mood? The people in Kabul, what were they feeling? What did you feel they wanted for their country? And was that kind of what they've got? Or is that a means of survival that they've swapped to this?
Yeah, very, very good question. And as always, I mean, to start any sentence with all Afghans or all Afghans in Kabul, it doesn't, whatever comes next will be false. So, there's a spectrum. And, you know, to generalize, you've got more conservative Afghans living in rural areas that haven't had the access to education and so on for forever, and who have always lived this very tribal religious life, to those in Kabul who, particularly over the last 20 years, as well as during the 80s when the Soviets were there. And, you know, we hear this when we think about the Soviet invasion in the 80s, it's always, for us anyway, cast in the light of the Cold War. The Soviets had invaded and they were the enemy, and the Americans assisted the rebels in defeating them. However, they were more or less doing exactly the same thing as the Americans went in and did. They propped up the Afghan government. They bought in education and health and built roads and hospitals and apartment complexes. And so the two eras were kind of similar in that way. And in Kabul, in that era in the last 20 years, you had a lot of people benefiting from education and prosperity, maybe less prosperity in the communist era, but you know, a lot of the economy thrived and the you know, employment skyrocketed and maternal mortality went down. That was mostly in the big cities where those benefits were reaped. And so it was mostly in the big cities, and especially Kabul, where people stood to lose a lot. So there's no way to typecast the all Afghans, but, you know, they all fall somewhere on that spectrum. Yeah. And yes, so some would have been happy with the return of the Taliban. For one, it meant the end of the war.
Yeah.
So especially for Afghans living in rural areas who had suffered the most during the war. Those in Kabul, however, who had reaped the rewards while the violence ended for the most part, it, you know, it meant that business and prosperity just fell off a cliff overnight. Schools shut down. High school girls are not going to school anymore. All the investment in the country is gone. And just the general hope for the future has disappeared. So everyone's falling somewhere on that spectrum.
I mean, you've gotten to know Afghanistan, Kabul quite well. But as we've just kind of you've just kind of explained, that could change tomorrow, what you knew, and it did change in one day a year ago. When did you make that move? When did you decide? Had you done much other kind of international stuff, or, you know, foreign kind of photojournalism? Did you get a taste of something similar to Afghanistan before you launched in there, or was it, you know, Cronulla riots, localized Sydney kind of photography into the war? Where did you find yourself in between, you know, Cronulla and the fallen Kabul?
Between those years, I kept working at Fairfax at the Financial Review, and then I spent a couple of years or a year working overseas, and that's where I sort of started to get an idea that I could take my work outside of Fairfax, not necessarily outside of Australia, but start working for international publications. So I went freelance and started working for papers in the US, and then I had this harebrained idea that, oh, well, these are the outlets I want to work for, so I should go and live where their offices are in New York, you know, with a million other photographers. And now I'm at the bottom of the pile and scrapping for whatever work I can get. And it wasn't until a friend back in Sydney told me she was going to Afghanistan. She wanted to write a story about the Afghan cricket team. She asked me if I knew any photographers she could work with over there. And I just sort of, without thinking about it, said, oh, I'll come with you.
Really?
Yeah. So we went, we first flew to Lebanon. We sort of tried to make a couple of stories there. And that was my first taste of a conflict zone. I mean, it wasn't, there was violence there, and there was, it was tense, and there was sort of military on the streets up in the north. There was a bit of tension overflowing from Syria up in the north. So that was the first taste I got of it. And from there, we went to Afghanistan and spent most of our time in Kabul. But I had this renewed passion for photography, and even a greater passion for photography than I'd found before. I, you know, finally found, you know, like that day at the riots, I felt like I was in the right place. I had a use for my photography. And so that was kind of it. Yeah.
I want to ask about what drew you to stay in Kabul for so long, but I also wanted to know, I know times are changing quickly, even from 9 or 10 years ago, the commercial realities of covering stories like this for news organisations and, you know, people's attention for these kind of stories to stay in and stay locked in. What was it like in terms of that first trip to, say, Lebanon and then to Kabul? Were you doing that on a freelance basis, or were you doing it for an agency or a newspaper and they were providing you to go for a couple of months to get what you can, come up with some stories, come up with some content? How did it work in that sense?
It was very much on spec,
yeah,
which is the term we use to means basically self-funding it. We, you know, paid for our tickets, paid for fixes and interpreters and accommodation and things in the hope that we would get a story published. We would never have made back the money we invested in that trip, though. So it's kind of something you probably need to do if you want to break into a new region or a new, you know, area of any industry, I guess. Or
new discipline, yeah.
Yeah. So, for those first few months, it was, I was basically, you know, I was reaching out to editors that I already knew in Australia, in the US, and telling them, hey, I'm here now. A lot of them already had their go-to photographers to work with, but, you know, slowly over time, you know, maybe one of those photographers wasn't available and, you know, they call me in an emergency, say, can you do this work? And you work for them and then your name's published. And slowly, it was actually Instagram played a big part in enabling me to put my name out there, put my pictures out there and make it known that I was there and was based there. I ended up on a couple of, you know, lists of photojournalists to follow. Yeah. And
so early days of that stuff too, right? Yeah.
171K followers, I think, on Instagram. If you want to get out there and go and follow Andrew. But not typical Instagram content that some people might associate with the platform.
He was promoting skinny tea earlier. he's a real influencer. A
lot of teeth whitening stuff. What drew you then to stay when you got there after that couple of months and you started getting established? What was it that made you go, this is where I want to be? You were talking about you felt like there was that place. But
did you fall in love with Afghanistan? Did that ever happen?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's a bit of an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
And here I am now kind of going cold turkey from it. But I definitely fell in love with it. And not just the country itself and the work I was doing there, but also the community that I made. And there's a good, there's a group of people that were all, regardless of their age, at similar points in their life to me at the time, I guess. You know, people that didn't have responsibilities or kids or... Yeah. partners or whatnot, and so we had that sort of collegial like-mindedness and
a bit of camaraderie. Push.
Yeah,
we had the London push, the Kabul push. There were different work as well, like what kind of aid workers or not all just media?
No, not all just media at all. It was and by 2013-14 when I arrived, it had shrunk a lot. I mean, in the I don't know if anyone's seen that movie Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. I think that was, you know, it was that following a journalist in Kabul at the height of the war there, I think in 2010 or something. And from friends who were there at the time, they kind of describe it as actually being pretty accurate.
Yeah.
By the time I was there, the international military presence had shrunk by about 90%. And so too had the media presence and the development and aid presence. So it had shrunk, but it was like a core... Mm. group of people and as you say, aid workers and human rights lawyers and what do they say, misfits, mercenaries and one other thing, can't remember what I fit into.
Maniacs. Media.
I
mean, there's obviously the danger you would put yourself in out in the field and that will not put yourself in but find yourself in, you know, surrounded by conflict. I kind of want to talk though a little bit about, there's always got to be a neutrality, there's always got to be a normal that you find yourself, that you forge, even in a city like that.
You still have to have a bit of fun.
Well, you know, well, there's that, of course, and I'm sure the dinner parties with the mercenaries and misfits were a great time. But when you kind of look at, someone goes to America, right? Someone goes to New York like you did as a young man, and you find out they haven't got health insurance or travel insurance. And you go, what are you doing, mate? You know what you're putting yourself... Did you have to pray that you didn't get a random lump on your arm? There's an element of that too, because you actually don't have the same... You're completely removed from what we know as, you know, a standard of healthcare, of services, of that kind of... Like, were you living in a flat? What is life like for a local, you know, albeit expat, but a local in Kabul?
Yeah, you're right. And particularly as a freelancer, you know, it's that calculus of... Do I want to bet against myself and, you know, insure myself for kidnap and ransom? For a freelancer, it's completely unaffordable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as far as insurance goes, I would, if I knew I was going on a particularly dangerous area or on a particularly dangerous assignment, I would buy insurance for like a couple of days.
Yeah.
But when I was in Kabul, no, it would just, like anywhere, the most dangerous thing to do in Kabul is probably ride a motorcycle around as I did, you know, getting caught in a traffic accident. The likelihood of getting blown up is small, even though, you know, my kind sort of tend to run towards them than away from them. But life in general, it was good. I mean, you could, it was affordable. It was a place where there wasn't really anything to spend your money on. Mm-hmm. So you could actually save money there. The lifestyle in between, it wasn't, I didn't really feel like I was sacrificing anything. We could afford to live in, you know, nice old, very simple houses, but with big, beautiful gardens, lots of grass, rose gardens and veggie patches and so on. And it was very social. We'd have, you know, we'd have like brunches on Fridays, which is the weekend there. And we built a pizza oven in the backyard. We built a hot tub and
you're living with a few others.
Living with a few others, yeah, sort of a rotating group of journalists and aid workers and so on. And, you know, life was kind of good and exciting. And when stuff happened, when, you know, when there was fighting in the city or when an explosion happened, it was, it would bring people close together. And you'd have some of my fondest memories are coming together with close friends after a night of covering some explosion or a burial followed one, and everyone's pretty shaken up and wondering where everyone is. Is everyone okay? And you come together and, you know, you share these very intense experiences that are, I suppose, I can only equate to those that that soldiers talk about. Mm-hmm. and which they can only relate to with one another once they come home.
Yeah. I mean, there's that too, you know. I mean, you look to anyone who's kind of found themselves in work in a country so different to what we know. How do you go? You mentioned cold turkey before. And I don't want to talk too much about, you know, the similarities between soldiers coming home and someone who's been on the ground working as a photojournalist coming home. I'm sure there's a whole range of hurdles. But just in terms of that, slipping back into a world where you press a button and wait until the street tells you when to cross, which you're now becoming familiar with again.
You don't have to press a button anymore. I've recently learned that's all automated.
Yeah, the COVID automation.
That's freaking me out.
Are you constantly grappling with this idea of organized chaos versus, you know, unbridled rules of living in Sydney?
Yeah, well, I lost, I think, 10 points on my license in the first month of being back.
Of course.
So, yeah, that was a quick learning curve. It's tricky. I mean, I've never had that sort of culture shock that I've heard other friends talk about where they walk into Woolies and, you know, see like 50 different types of hand soap and have a meltdown. I've never had that happen. And you know, it's funny, you very quickly fall back into the, you know, the quote unquote first world problems that on short trips you come back and notice, you know, amongst your friends and family, and you kind of like, you know, get a bit of perspective, people, you know. But yeah, it's very strange how quickly I fall back into that. But having said that, yeah, it's very, I mean, for me, the bigger challenge has been, or will be, and is finding the purpose that I had over there, which is, you know, pretty hard to replicate here, you know, fortunately for us living here.
Yeah. It's an interesting one too, because you've also come back to a news landscape that, you know, can't really provide like they did, you know, when you were at Fairfax, and when they would have, there'd be things for you to do and there'd be consistent work. So this book, was this a result of that, or you always had this in your mind?
No, it definitely wasn't a result of that, but yeah. I mean, that was quite...
A vacuum of everyday work, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost the opposite, actually, in Afghanistan, because there were so few people there to fill the roles of journalists and photographers and videographers. There were times when I, as a photographer, would have photos that required words to go with them, and there was no one else to do it. So I sort of stepped in and I was like, well, I'll give this a go.
Yeah.
As a lot of journalists do these days, you know, journalists are taking photos on their phones and being asked to do video and podcasts and everything, you know. So I started sort of finding a balance between photography and writing. And about 18 months ago, or a year before the fall of Kabul, Melbourne Uni Press got in touch with me and were interested in trying to find an idea for a book. And we were going back and forth for several months. And then once the writing appeared on the wall that the Taliban were coming back, it became very obvious to us all that this was the subject to write on. And then it became about making sure I was there.
Yeah. Oh, so the book came first. It wasn't you come back, perched up in Sydney, and go, you know what, I should put that into a book. It was pre.
It was pre, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so I spent couple of months after the fall, reporting specifically for the book.
A lot of people might look at it and go, the logical decision was to get out of Kabul as quickly as possible. But I think from talking to you, it sounds like it might have been a very difficult decision to leave Kabul in the end. Was that the case when you had to pack up and go? Was it a really tough decision to make?
Yeah, very much so. It was home. And it just got to a point where I realised that the people that had made it home had all gone, and the city felt very different all of a sudden. And so, yeah, I was very torn. I mean, I also knew that it was time for me to go, regardless of what was happening there, regardless of, I mean, you know, there'd be tons of work to do there at the moment that I could be doing. But it was just, it got to a point, certainly last year drilled at home, that, yeah, I needed some time out. And yeah, like I said, that abusive relationship got to the point where I had to sort of cut it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you ever see yourself, do you look around the world and see countries and start thinking, you know, or not countries, but places where you think that could be another Afghanistan for me? Or are you cut off from that kind of line of, you know, you're removing yourself from that kind of work for a little while too?
For the time being, I'm removing myself. I certainly wonder whether I could find another Afghanistan. And a lot of my colleagues who have come and gone from Kabul before I did have tried and failed to sort of to find a replacement for Kabul. It did have a strange equilibrium where you're able to sort of live a semi-normal life while being in the middle of this conflict that will be, you know, remembered like Vietnam or the wars before and after it. But, you know, a lot of people have assumed that I would instinctively go to Ukraine, for example, but it's not like that at all. Like, I don't consider myself a war photographer. I think I was in Afghanistan photographing a place that was in conflict, but it wasn't, I mean, it was, the conflict was there, but it wasn't necessarily the reason I was there.
And are there people that would be in Afghanistan now? Have you met the guys, like people, men and women along the way who do bounce between these places, or are you more the archetype?
No, there are different kind of molds for freelance journalists and staff journalists and photographers. You either have the ones that, you know, have a base and then they hop between, you know, Ukraine, Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, South America, Africa.
Cowboy stuff.
You know, like parachute journalists, as we call them. And then you have the ones that sort of base themselves in a place, like try and learn the language a bit, get a real in-depth understanding of it. Yeah, I can't quite work out where I want to be now. And, you know, I may look to find something entirely different altogether.
Big wave surfing.
Yeah.
Well, you're living in Maroubra now. You can get some work laying carpet down there with the Bra Boys. There's plenty of work going down that way. But yes, this book is amazing. For those listening at home in the tractor or in the back of the high ace, you should get yourself a copy. August in Kabul by Andrew Quilty. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, guys.